copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Well, good morning, brothers and sisters. It's a privilege to be with you and honor to be amongst the great lineup they have at this conference. And, you know, I can say as a young European many years ago, I would have died to have something like this. You know, it was one of my dreams. In fact, a lot of my energy in my early ministry was trying to build coalitions and things that would result in something like this. In fact, the European Leadership Forum, as we came to a climax of what we called Hope for Europe at the beginning of it in 2000, was really the launch of the European Leadership Forum in Budapest. And then it took on a life of its own, which has been marvelous to see it grow from strength to strength. And originally in Shapalma, and then Sopron, and then out in Eger, and then now moving here to Wisła, which is fantastic to see in beautiful Poland. So really, it's a thrill to be with you. These thoughts that I'm going to share with you today are, I'm a grassroots person, not necessarily an intellectual in any sense of the word, but I desire to present the gospel as faithfully as I can, and I've done that most of my Christian life. I became a Christian in Scotland with no church background whatsoever. I was a bouncer in a dance hall, so I came in through a direct conversion. And when God gets a hold of your heart, you're in. I began working in Eastern Europe. My first missions trip, I was put in prison for 40 days in Yugoslavia. So that was my introduction. And then I managed to get 3 more arrests, one in Russia, one in East Germany, and one in Czechoslovakia. Over the years. So that was always a baptism of understanding about the centrality of the gospel and that was the issue. And I remember going through interrogations by communist authorities and thinking, of course, was I with the CIA? Was I with MI5? Was I funded by some perverse organization? And, you know, honestly, I would say, no, I'm sent here by my father. Oh, what does your father do? Well, you know, he runs the universe. And no, we're not talking about that, you know. So, and I wasn't trying to be cute. I mean, honestly, I was just naive at the time. You know, I just thought that made sense. You know, well, how do you get your money? Well, father gives it to me. What does your father do? I said, I told you, he runs the universe. No, your real father. So I had to wise it up a little bit that there was a way to engage. But the centrality of the gospel is a conversational experience of God who reveals himself to us. And then my own journey was trying to share the gospel with Europeans living in Austria, working with Russians and Romanians and Hungarians and later with Spanish and Greeks and others. The European consciousness, this deep secularism that is a part of our continent where Christianity is a part-time hobby for some. The Hollies and Lilies clubs, you know, where people go to Easter or, you know, they're married and buried and whatever. But Christianity is more of a cultural phenomenon rather than a lived experience with an answer to the world's questions. So trying to go through that journey and learn, coming from a bouncer background, was not an easy experience, tell me. But as John said this morning, the centrality of the scriptures, the renewing of the mind that comes by God's word is the key for me. So we are confessional people. We are called to witness, and we struggle constantly with methods and methodologies. I really get tired of the endless apologetic debates where someone is looking for the one true method. Are you a classical apologist? Are you presuppositionalist and all the rest? I said, I'm a classical evidentialist presuppositionalist. I mean, you deal with human beings, you listen to the Holy Spirit, and then you use the proper tools that God allows at that moment. I'm not against methodology, we use them. But we spend so much time trying to sort out what we believe and which school we fit in that we ignore the people that we're trying to witness to and the context. And that should be driving us in the voice of our God. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, 17 through 21, I think is a great place to anchor our thinking. Paul speaking this classic passage, of course, to the Corinthians of all people in that home of Roman interaction with the Jewish community there in the town, the seat of the Isthmus Games, and so much going on in this city. Paul says here in chapter 5, 17 through 21, therefore, if anyone is in Christ, he's a new creature. The old things passed away, behold, new things have come. Now, all these things are from God, who reconciled us to himself through Christ and gave us the ministry of reconciliation, namely that God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself, not counting their trespasses against them. He has committed to us the word of reconciliation. Therefore, we are ambassadors for Christ, as though God were making an appeal through us. We beg you on behalf of Christ, be reconciled to God. He made him who knew no sin to be sin on our behalf, that we might become the righteousness of God in him. It's probably fewer great synopsis or gathering of the gospel understanding than that one scripture. I have used that many a time in counseling someone struggling with faith or with self-worth. Said, write it on great big cards, stick it in front of your bed every morning you wake up. He made him who knew no sin to be sin on our behalf, that we might become the righteousness of God in him. That's a great confession. So Christians, as Christians, we're in the reality business. We believe that reality is of a particular nature. That means we believe that there's such a thing as truth, and we believe that we are called to persuade. We are called to witness in the marketplace. We're a called out people, and our first passion, therefore, is to indwell our relationship with God, to dwell in the church, to dwell in worship, to really inhabit our narrative so that it gives us our categories, it frames our thinkings, it socializes us, it forms us into the kind of people who are journeying with God. But in our mission, as we well know, we're living in occupied territory. The world, as Eugene Peterson says, is no friend to grace. That's a great phrase. We know that out there is hostility. You step outside the doors of your, you know, you might be in great worship and great excitement, a great conference here, and you go out Monday morning and you're back into the reality of bureaucracy and other views and the news inundating us with other information. So beliefs, ideologies, convictions, and passions abound. It's not a neutral climate for witness. This is the Babylonian world in which we're witnessing. And so we face the clash of worldviews. And one of the things we find often, and I found in my early Christianity, that I was not equipped, and no one did give me any equipment, how to engage the people of other belief systems. In other words, there was preaching that really led to a form of dualism and pietism in my spiritual life. So the world was very clear. There was public, private, sacred, secular, in here, out there. And as a Christian, I often struggled to relate the two. So there was a wall of silence. Now, I chose to work in the mission world, so therefore I was propelled out there. But I came up against intellectual barriers. And sometimes I would use my Bible verses and I'd throw scripture at people, but they didn't believe in the Bible. They didn't believe in God. So some of the pre-existing stuff was being unaddressed. So Austin Farrer said this once, though argument does not create conviction, the lack of it destroys belief. What seems to be proven may not be embraced. What no one shows the ability to defend is quickly abandoned. Rational argument does not create belief, but it maintains a climate in which belief may flourish. And I think one of the challenges to the gospel in Europe today, and indeed across the Western world, is to get public communication of the gospel back at a proclamation form. We need evangelism at the grassroots level. We need apologetics both in the church and also at the level so Christians are comfortable in their faith and can engage it. But we need public advocacy. You need Christians who are lawyers and doctors and at the top of their game, businessmen, politicians, who also can give a defense of the Christian faith at that realm of society and can witness strongly to that. But in the meantime, while we wait for the ideal world to arrive or whatever, we have to work with the tools we have, with the moment that has been given to us. So we have to look for opportunities or create them under the leadership of the Spirit for dialogue, for witness, and always consulting the scriptural narrative. What is the Bible saying? How does the Spirit form us? What is that Kevin Van Hooser's phrase, theodramatic, if you like, impulse that we have to follow and shape as we follow what God is saying? So apologetics, as far as I'm convinced more and more, has to involve imagination and creativity. It can't just be a passive response to someone else's questions. There is that part, defensive apologetics. But proactive apologetics means we have to go in and create context where we put the questions on the table, where we're challenging the unbelievers, where we're saying, like C.S. Lewis did, it makes more sense to be a Christian than not to be one, and to give arguments on that basis. Ravi, in summing up his kind of a philosophy, if you like, of how he does in communication, said two key realities sum up an effective apologetic: how to relate to the questioner and how to make sure the answers are couched in a relevant context. If we miss those two converging lines, we miss the opportunity. So what I find oftentimes is when I'm in conferences, people come up and they have all kinds of questions and they're purely abstracts. Theoretical questions that they may be thinking in their own imagination, but you try to find it. Was that a real person asking a real question. Was it someone that asked you this, or is this just some objection that you yourself have created in your own mind and are trying to answer all the questions before you ever witness? So when we're in a ministry situation, we're always trying to understand, where am I? Am I in New York City speaking to the elite liberal culture, or am I standing in Abu Dhabi speaking to a Muslim culture, and the person asking the question comes from a devout Sunni background? The context is clear, and therefore the questioner is also coming different. Maybe the same question, why should I believe in Jesus? But context and the individual is how we frame it. So let me go through this. What I'll do is I'll go by section and we'll stop. You can throw stones or whatever you'd like to do. And then we'll move on to respond to the question. So first, the meaning quest. I think this is one of the deepest quests of the heart. John mentioned it this morning. It's built into the DNA of our life. We want to know who we are and what we are. Why am I? Does anything have meaning? And Europeans love this question, as you know. The French have invested a lot of work on this question, as have the Germans, and had the Greeks did a long time before them. And it isn't going away. If you look at our movies, you look at our songs, you look at all around us, there's a sense of hunger and despair. But who cares about this question? Cardinal Pupard, one time president of the Pontifical Council of Culture, said, "The church today is confronted more by indifference and practical unbelief than with atheism. Atheism is in decline throughout the world, but indifference and unbelief develop in cultural milieus marked by secularism. It's no longer a question of public affirmation of atheism, with the exception of a few countries, but of a diffuse presence, almost omnipresent, in the culture." In other words, I think what he's getting at, and I think it's fair, is there's more of this sense of whatever. The Christianity, you know, it may have something, but it's past its sell-by date, been there, bought that, you know, done that, bought the tea. Can't possibly have anything to say that is really real or anything public or anything relevant, not in the world of economics or in the worlds of democracy or in the world of philosophy or the world of anything that we consider important today. And yet you and I deeply believe that it does. But we need to get visibility and we need to get present. In other words, we face a real plausibility issue. And plausibility is a thing we have to win with people at different levels, individually and also publicly. But this hunger for meaning is an inescapable demand. I don't know how many of you have read the writings of Viktor Frankl. Viktor was a survivor from Auschwitz. And of course, you're literally 30, 40 kilometers away. If you haven't seen it, you need to. Dreadful, dreadful place. And the bigger camp at Treblinka, you see the scale of what was done there and the slaughter. In fact, reading the biography of Rudolf Hess, the commandant, is an interesting story in itself, as he was brought in to testify against Kaltenbrunner, who was the head of the Gestapo, and just coldly would tell the numbers and the efficiency and the organization and the power. It's an incredible story. And didn't think he was doing anything, because he was killing a Jew was like killing a rat. I mean, what was it? It wasn't a thing. It wasn't a person. It was just a thing. And he was doing a cultural favor, he thought. But in the midst of this, Frankl saw that the search for meaning was intrinsic to the human story. People wanted meaning. The hunger for hope. In fact, he was the founder of, you know, of logotherapy. And this meaning question will not go away. Milan Kundera, his famous book a number of years back, The Unbearable Lightness of Being. And what modernity does and postmodernity has done as it's gone into hyper-reality is to thin life out. So everything is surface and superficial. There's no gravitas, no weight, no solidity. Things come into formation and then we destroy them. We talk about creative destruction and capitalism. We create businesses and then they go away. We have internet bubbles and they burst. And we get used to this kind of idea of things flowing up and flowing down. But we're crying out, who are we? Two movies recently that spoke about this very powerfully, the film Gravity. If you see this idea, beautiful film, marvelously filmed, but the hunger for transcendence and the sense of sorrow and brokenness and pain with the world as a backdrop, this drama in space, and about this woman really crying out to God, essentially, in the film, looking for an answer. And at the end, the last really scene is almost an act of thanksgiving. In the film, Her. You have this person who's searching, trying, wanting desperately a relationship, and then falls in love with his technology. And of course, we know we've seen parodies of this, but we see this now, a recent survey in Britain that said how many people, a fifth of the population, would say they would be happy to have sex with a robot if such was possible. So our world is changing, and yet we're hungering for answers. The cry for meaning, and you see this answered very powerfully, or at least addressed by Lewis and Pascal, amongst others. So the wisdom of C.S. Lewis, Michael Ward says, apologetics is usually defined as a reasoned defense. In Lewis's view, reason could only operate if it was first supplied with materials to reason about. And it was imagination's task to supply these materials. Therefore, apologetics was necessarily and foundationally imaginative. So a great weakness at times is to focus sometimes on apologetics purely as an act of reason and reasoning. Now, we don't have to play into what side are we, modernists and foundational, are we postmodern, you know, this kind of thing. Again, I think that obscures the question. We're talking about Christian communication and how we go after people's lives, how we work with God, and therefore reason and imagination are both essential. Lewis wrote this, and I think this is very helpful, very inspiring. He said, to summarize his definitions, this is Alistair McGrath on Lewis, reason is the natural organ of truth, imagination is the organ of meaning, and meaning itself is the antecedent condition of both truth and falsehood. Imagination is therefore, for Lewis, the prius of truth. Before something can either be true or false, it must mean. Now, I find this very, very helpful, and maybe we can stop here and have a few questions at this point because that's one of the junctures. But the whole idea of where he makes this distinction between reason as the organ of truth and imagination as the organ of meaning, that might sound strange in the beginning, but when you think about it for a few minutes, you'll see there's a great validity in that. Oftentimes, what we struggle with is to get a picture of something. And if a picture is born or some kind of encounter, then often our reason now connects and can tie it together. So it's not a picture or reasons, but a picture sustained by reasons or a picture from reasons generated by the reasons, whichever way it works. But the idea is, again, to get the imagination so that truth is not just seen and understood cognitively, it's felt. And Schaeffer, I think, very much understood this as an aspect of going after the heart. So let me take a couple of seconds and if you want clarification or... Reason is the organ of truth and imagination is the organ of meaning. It's in one of those, I think, it should be in your notes, footnoted, it's the Blush Spells and Philasteries. It's one of those strange Lewis essays, I think, where he addresses that, but it's a very, very useful passage. And remember, he's writing as a professor of literature. And, I mean, I think one of Lewis's great strengths was his communication power. So, you know, that was a strong aspect of that. All right, let's move on a little bit, and then 2 Corinthians again, 5, 18 and 19. Though all these things are from God who reconciled us to himself through Christ and gave us the ministry of reconciliation. So I think, namely, God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself, not counting their trespasses against them, and he has committed to us the word of reconciliation. So Stephen Covey famously says, begin with the end in mind. And I find that that's a very helpful thing because as a young person, as a leader, many times I began without any end in mind. You know, it's like fire, ready, aim. And you came up with a plan or a strategy after you were doing something or someone asked you a question and you seem to think you know. But it really helps us to keep burrowing down to ourselves. Why am I doing this? Is this effective? Is this something that makes sense? So here's, first of all, some definitions on apologetics. McGrath puts it this way. Apologetics is best thought of as a principled attempt to defend and commend the Christian faith, both meeting objections that might be raised against it and attempting to explore and explain its potential attraction to those who have yet to discover it. So I think we'd all agree there's at least a twofold aspect of apologetics. There's negative apologetics in which you're defending and responding to attacks. But positive apologetics, which was very much more where Lewis went, I think, is to proactively drive into the marketplace, drive into the university, drive into the world with arguments for God. Speaking on an apology for apologetics, John Milbank speaks of apology as narrative, argument, confession, and imaginative witness by the human person in the name of the divine personality against the hitherto impersonality of the city, shades of John Lennox this morning, that is the very heart of the Christian theology. So that, again, that Christians need to be, therefore have a creative bent to this. If we're always on the defense, we're always on the back foot, we're always standing back, just responding to things and not going after things. And I think as Christians, there are lots of opportunities to us to get into the place and give a Christian answer and a Christian defense. A few years ago, I was down in Hong Kong, and as part of a team effort down there, we were summoned to speak in one of the large bank buildings. So, you know, Hong Kong's a magnificent city. It was just across where the Dark Knight dives out from the building. So you've seen we're up there on the 44th floor, and there's all these corporate lawyers, and there's three of us. And we have about, I think, 35 minutes before us, because these are business people, and we're supposed to give a Christian presentation in response to their questions. So they finally broke it down. All right, you've got like 5 minutes each. So my two colleagues spoke, and then it was just over. Then my one colleague spoke, and then it was over to me and this one other guy. We did a kind of quick synopsis. And the first question out was from this corporate lawyer. Okay, the man says, I'm a Buddhist. What makes your Christianity so unique? Why should we believe this? And John Dixon from Australia said, history, wounds, and grace. Just like that. Three words. History, wounds, and grace. And then we unpacked those for the next few minutes. And that actually set it up beautifully. Three simple words in a public setting that there was something unique about the God of history and Christianity as a historical faith. Wounds, that we worship a God who suffers and dies for us. That's a unique. And grace, that there's nothing you can do to pull yourself up by your bootstraps to get up to God. That grace is that God comes down to us. That's the Christian message in a nutshell. And then we spent the rest of the time, we went, you know, we were divided and taken off for coffees and whatever, and off we went, running. But it was a great way to get them, and they got that. That was not Buddhism. That was not Hinduism. It was not Confucianism. So they knew immediately, and now we're having a distinct conversation about that. But I really appreciated John's synopsis. So the necessity of translation in Acts 17, of course, 22 and 23, you know, we all have to mention that in any apologetic talk, don't we? So Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus. He said, men of Athens, I observe that you are very religious in all respects. While I was passing through and examining the objects of your worship, I found an altar with this inscription, to an unknown God. Therefore, what you worship in ignorance, this I proclaim to you. That phrase always stuns me. I mean, can you imagine, you know, here in Saudi Arabia or, you know, down in New York City or wherever, and, you know, yeah, that which you're worshiping ignorance, let me tell you the truth about this. We have to reframe it, obviously, a little bit for our times, but it is challenging. Lewis learned very quickly as a professor coming out of the university that when he was asked to speak to the RAF and he was to do lectures on the BBC, that he was using the wrong kind of language. So he learned about translation, and he said this: you must translate every bit of your theology into the vernacular. This is very troublesome, and it means that you can say very little in half an hour, but it's essential. It's also the greatest service to your own thought. I've come to the conviction, if you cannot translate your thoughts into uneducated language, then your thoughts are confused. Power to translate is the test of having really understood one's own meaning. So what McGrath was burrowing down, Alistair was looking at, he wrote a new biography of Lewis, he was looking at Lewis's intellectual thought, and we were exchanging some comments on this. I was trying to probe him in some things. I liked some of the things he put in his book, The Intellectual World of C.S. Lewis. He said, what is required is a cultural translation which attempts to express ideas from one language embedded in its social context to another language embedded in a different social context. Translation is a cultural, not simply a linguistic matter. And this means that we have to learn to read our context. I can't tell you how many times I've got this wrong. I mean, I've had to travel and preach all over the world, and, you know, you think you want something that works in one setting, and if anybody's an international traveler and speaks in different, you know what this is like? Can I speak to these people in a way that will not offend them, or say something that's going to be a bombshell, or even that just doesn't translate? I'm using illustrations that don't relate to their world at all, or they don't even think this way, they don't feel there. So trying to translate, enter into their poetry, the soul of a nation, entering into the background. That's why, you know, you go to Albania and you need to learn a few things about Milan Kundera. Jerzim Kiryazi, sorry, I was thinking about the background of some of the writers in their culture, people that have formed their culture, a little bit of poetry and knowledge to get a feel for the soul of a nation if we're going to try to talk to people. But I think we have to do this all the time. We have to do this with our kids. We have to do this with our different contexts. So it's a creative enterprise, therefore, apologetics. You see that in Acts chapter 17, 24 through 31, where Paul then gets up and, of course, he draws, as we know, from poets and poetry and uses this in his speech to the Athenians, and he's commending the gospel. Here's what McGrath says, though, about Lewis and his methodology. He said, Lewis did not content himself with translating words into other words. He proved adept at interweaving and transposing words, images, and narratives. And that's something I have really wrestled with and struggle. I think, to be honest, I think Ravi is one of the very gifted at this. He goes globally, and I'm amazed that in different contexts, he can be speaking to Muslims, he can be speaking in Russia, he can speak, and he finds a way to capture the imagination. Some people, if we get a lot of criticism, well, he's not really a philosopher. He doesn't claim to be. But he does connect with the gospel in the public square, and he finds ways to get that message. And I see others learning to do that. So this is something I think that is very, very crucial. I want to take a question here or carry on? Go ahead. So the question was about the definition of apologetics and as an embodied expression and a much more holistic demonstration. Christianity has always been really a show-and-tell religion. So, I mean, you know, the Gospels are about all that Jesus began to do and teach. So that's in the tradition. I think very much like John 14:6, you know, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And we've historically often done that proposition, illustration, application. But I think a lot in this generation, people say they're looking for applications. Look, give me a life scenario. Why do we do it? What way? And what's the basis of that? The truth. So you go to the back, you show, and you give the reason for it. But apologetic definitions have to be practical to yourself. I mean, Greg Pritchard uses the one, the art and science of Christian persuasion. I think that's a good definition at one level. So what we don't want it to be is apologetics to be everything and nothing. I agree with you that commending it and embodying it and showing it is a part of that. So communication is symbolic. It's a part of being a member of the church. It's a part of the healing community of a place of forgiveness that we do marriage and we do relationship, we do sexuality, we handle our economics a particular way. And then we demonstrate that by being proactive in our mission through deeds of service and love and grace married to words that give explanation for the narrative structure. So the words are not unimportant, but the words then find a context. But you're right, I think that's an embodied expression is absolutely crucial. The question is that in Christian vocabulary, sometimes words like justification and other words are maybe difficult, and it's Lewis asking whether we explain them or find alternatives. I think it's actually a combination of both, but I think what Lewis would be looking for is finding metaphors and bridges. So you get the concept that, you know, and he would, well, look at Mere Christianity, the way the book is written. It starts out with it's a classically British scenario, people standing and waiting in line and someone breaks in. So he arouses the sense of morality to raise the question of what is right and just in the world, and is there such a thing, and why do we have this moral sense? Is there a moral sense, something transcendent? I really do think that that's the way, and that fits, I think, with what the young lady was saying as well, that, you know, justification simply stated as a proposition with no concept in our world that ties to it currently, or you can find, but they're not, they're weak, would be better to get scenarios that you lay it out, and then you introduce justification as maybe at the tail end of the argument now is something that ties it together, a biblical definition. Because it's here, it's in our world, but we're not quite sure where does it in our judicial system? Is it in our economic system today? Clearly, people on television all want to, on the blogs, all want to justify themselves. They want to be seen to be right. So there's a very human desire for something like that. But the idea of deeper righteousness and where that comes from, I think you need to win people into this. And then this is the language of Scripture, giving them that language, but they've got to experience the reality of it and then be given the... All right, well, let's move on a little bit then and actively seeking connections. Again, where Paul says he observed that they were religious in all respects. I like that. Now, one of the things that I have tried to do is when I'm traveling or where I'm with people is look around. The Eurythmics in their song, Sweet Dreams, everybody's looking for something. Sweet dreams are made of these. Annie Lennox, come on. Okay, all right, I know it dates me. It's the 80s, but you know, hey, that's all right. Well, we've got a jazz player back there. He's older than that. No, sorry. So the evangelist apologist must seek out what's being sought or hoped for and desired. And again, going back to the young lady's question over here, or the observation about there are trains of desire. It's in our advertising. It wouldn't work. Why are people queuing up for iPhones? Why is it that the men's, there's even a hint of something new on Apple? Ding, you know, people are going for now. No, that's the Apple missionaries. But you know what I'm saying? They're out there with a fashion. So we're looking for what is it and where is this desire aimed? It may be aimed for purely emotional reasons. It may be, but often, subconsciously, it's tied to identity and meaning. People are wanting to be something. They want to perform their lives. And one of the things I think we're crying out, and this has been backed up by a lot of literature in Europe and other, is the sense of lostness, a place for us. I don't remember the old song, there's a place for us somewhere, a place for us. Beautiful romantic song, anyway. But that sense, Novalis talked about homesickness for the ultimate truth. That there's a longing deep within for something, a place. And, you know, when you've been away after you've been gone to college or you're away, there's something about going back to some of those haunts. I mean, any of you knows your childhood? You go back to a little cafe that you used to go to, or you walk the street, you go to your school. Why do you go there? You left school long ago. You, in fact, you couldn't wait to get out of the place. And now you go back and you think, oh, isn't that great? And weren't my friends really nice? And, oh, what fun we had. Yeah, really. I mean, you just couldn't wait till the day you were gone forever. Sentence was over. But that sense connects us with a nostalgia, with a sense of place, with a hunger for something. Lewis and Pascal, again, picked on this idea of joy and longing or Sehnsucht. Here's Alison Milbank. She says, we need estranging techniques if we are to shock people into estrangement with reality, so that they may appreciate the religious sense and we can begin to explain the Christian faith at all. In the American South, one of the writers that did this is Flannery O'Connor, a Catholic writer who in her writing, it's actually pretty brutal, shocking stuff. But why did she do that? Because there was this civil religion that takes over a lot of Southern America, where people are outwardly looking religious, but really may have missed the grace of God. And sometimes the grace of God in a Flannery O'Connor book is revealed through the person who's doing the most evil. They become an instrument of showing grace. So this idea of estranging techniques, where we actually as Christians disturb people in their complacency, where we provoke them, not in a sense to make them angry, but I think to make them think, to make them feel, to go after their worldview. We need to find ways to disturb them in their complacency, to arouse them towards eternal hope. You do that by looking at the cries of the heart and various other things. So I think imagination's role and appeal comes into this. When Alistair was working on his book on Lewis, he really went through all the correspondence. In fact, he found some undiscovered treasures at Keble College that all went to do with why Lewis did not get tenure at Oxford. And as you know, he ended up in Cambridge. Some hidden correspondence that had been missed over the years in the university. But he captures the richness of what Lewis was doing as he read through all this letter and correspondence, more than in some of his explicit writing. He says, conveying the quality of religious experience to someone who has yet to discover it requires an appeal to the imagination. The very essence of our life as conscious beings, all day and every day, consists of something which cannot be communicated except by hints, similes, metaphors, and the use of emotions. You can see Lewis is a child of his time where they're themselves not very important, which are pointers to it. So he wasn't a big fan of the emotional life. But I like the summary that McGrath puts on Lewis's work here. He says, where some apologists offer a defense of individual Christian ideas, such as the existence of God, the incarnation, or the Trinity, and then argue for the truth of the Christian faith as a whole, Lewis inverts this procedure. The fundamental appeal of the Christian faith is imaginative and is grasped through an apprehension of the panorama of reality that it offers. Where some look at snapshots defended by reason, then paste them together to yield the big picture, Lewis argues that Christianity sets out a bold and brilliant illumination of the intellectual landscape, grasped through the imagination, which leads to reflection on its individual components. So he saw Lewis, in a sense, by his words, by his books, through the Narnia series, through other kind of things, as being almost like a picture painter. And I don't know if many of you know in the history of British Christianity, but one of the things that happened was when Dorothy Sayers did her the program, The Man Who Would Be King, it caused a sensation across Britain because it was putting the Jesus story into an idiom and a form that was really alien, and people thought they were violating the message. And it was, but what it did was it got all kinds of people discussing Christ and the gospel and reality. So this is a fine balance because we know we can obscure the message, we can mess it up, or we can indeed score a bullseye by getting people to look straight to where they need to look at. So this constant tension is one in which we have to challenge the world's aggressive attack upon us. So we have to reframe. I like that in movies, you know, sometimes when you get a picture, you know, they'll sometimes play with a shot to get the perfect shot. I'm a movie goer, by the way. I love film. There is something about good film. Something about a great scene. Sometimes when you can see it, but like, or even something like Downton Abbey. You know, what made Downton Abbey, apart from being a sensation from some of the script writing and all that kind of thing, but some of the shots where it's just perfectly lined out, the doors all open, the ladies all come out in their evening gown, and then the men, and it's magnificent in the craftsmanship of what is exactly positioned in that, the lighting, the colors, the setting. Art has a wonderful way to arouse the soul. But we need to tell the story. We need to reframe the story. Leslie Newbigin puts it this way, the business of the church is to tell and embody a story, the story of God's mighty acts in creation and redemption and of God's promises concerning what will be in the end. The church affirms that the truth of this story by celebrating it, interpreting it, and enacting it in the life of the contemporary world. Now again, this is not to set up a false dichotomy between narrative apologetics versus propositional apologetics. But narrative is the story of creation, what John was talking about, creation, fall, redemption. The big story that's going on in the universe, and being able to narrate that, connect people to it, find ways to make them feel it, giving them tastes of it through poetry, music, song, preaching, different ways to connect them in. Now, Newbegin had an interesting quote. This is where some people don't like some of the things he said. His was appealing to some of the rationalism at the turn of in the Enlightenment epistemology particularly, where sometimes Christians were denying the power of the gospel by trying to go to philosophy to justify why we did the gospel. So he says, speaking to the church, if it supposes that its truth can be authenticated by reference to some allegedly more reliable truth claim, such as those offered by the philosophy of religion, then it has implicitly denied the truth by which it lives. So what Newbegin wants to nail, and I really feel this very deeply myself, I believe that was the primacy, the Word became flesh. Jesus is the revelation of God in reality. A space-time point in history, Christ showed up, and that changed everything. This universe was created by God. Christ came to complete the story and tell us. And so he is our primary apologetic source and power. And therefore, we act from that axis. Any questions at this point? And we'll keep moving. Or we didn't understand this last quote and how does it relate to story. Basically, what Newbegin is saying is that the gospel itself, or the whole Bible, is a narrative of the nature of reality. It tells us about creation, fall, and redemption, and supremely in Christ. If the church takes that story and then sort of says, but the only way we can communicate this is first to establish a Greek or other philosophical category. God is unknowable, he's or blah, 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 he's all these attributes. And we establish all these philosophical categories first, and now we come and start interpreting Scripture through the primacy of philosophical categories, we've got the cart before the horse. So his point is that we may well use these things to illustrate as points to offer clarification as something of, you know, another philosopher says, and this sheds light on a theological truth. But the primacy is the theological truth that God has acted, and that that should determine our methods and our approach, and not philosophy. Does that? Okay, good. All right. Well, let's look on to keeping real persons in sight. Stephen Covey says, I said earlier, seek first to understand, then to be understood. So when we're communicating, I think the struggle we're all finding is we're looking with real people. Who is our audience? Who is it we're talking to? So knowing our audience, obviously, is step one. And I mean, I know that's elementary to us, but, you know, when you come in with ready-made talks, off-the-shelf canned stuff, and you come in and you just speak, then you really haven't taken time to know your audience. Many times I've seen that a talk that I thought would, and I come in and I get a look and I realize this isn't going to work at all. You're going to have to change everything and reframe it because it's a different kind of expectation. So McGrath wrote this. He said, the effective apologist must be able to identify with and enter into the experiential world of his or her audience. And that's not just bland acceptance, but a recognition of the imago Dei. I was recently in Carnegie Mellon, and I was up against a very formidable professor of philosophy who clearly was a Dawkinsite and had all these 3x5 cards, and he was coming out blasting at Christianity, not at me, because he actually didn't know who I was. So, and as the conversation unfolded, I mean, I really worked hard to get him to look at me, talk to me, and stop talking to stereotypes and caricatures. And it was funny, the audience were really reacting because he was setting himself up. He was said he's a professor of the Humanist Association, but there was nothing humane about his communication. He wasn't being nice, he wasn't being kind, he wasn't being fair, and he wasn't being accurate. So we talked about Christian humanism. We talked about what it meant to be made in the image of God by God, and we talked about the stereotypes that he was setting up, which were easily destroyed. And then so let's talk about commonality in a country like the United States of America, where there's the freedom of the religion, so we don't want either the dominance nor the removal of it. But it's the balance, the tension, the free exercise, which is in the First Amendment, and so forth. But anyway, it was a very interesting discussion, and I thought here was a case in point where he did not know his audience. He came to represent his team and basically criminalize Christianity. My job simply there was to say that the gospel has validity in the public square and to just see what happened. And as it happened, we get into some very good conversations that I think are going to lead to further meetings. So needs in people's life need to be felt as well as understood. I like this again. During the 1930s, Lewis became aware that reasoned argument on its own lacked existential force. It required rhetorical embellishment to secure both acceptance and transformation. In his preface to Paradise Lost, Lewis argued the proper use of rhetoric that shapes the human emotions was both lawful and necessary because, as Aristotle points out, intellect of itself moves nothing. The transition from thinking to doing by nearly all men at nearly all moments needs to be assisted by states of feeling. Now, we know that has good and bad side to it. Adolf Hitler moved a whole nation towards a catastrophe. Slobodan Milosevic did the same in Serbia a number of years back. Great rhetoric can be used as in bad senses, but it can also be used in a very positive sense. Think of Winston Churchill in 1940 and the speeches that he gave and many others. I think part of our job today, there's a phrase by the sociologist Zygmunt Bauman where he talked about life in fragments. The postmodern has shattered and broken things, and so we've lost narrative power, and of course we don't believe in stories with a capital S, we only believe in small story. So in a sense, we have a task as Christians that is difficult. How many of you as kids got those, your aunts or your uncles would come and give you a present, and you got these little dot-to-dot books? You remember those? You know, and you saw 1, 2, 4, 5, 6. Oh, look, a rectangular giraffe, or a diametrical, I don't know what it is, but oh, it's a refrigerator or something. You know, you had all these kind of strange things, and of course, you had to learn to, you know, follow the numbers, not completely straight lines, but it was a picture emerged when you joined the dots and you followed the numbers. What people have today out there is only the numbers with no pattern, and the numbers aren't necessarily even sequenced right. What Christians have, if our narrative is true, and it is, and if it describes reality, you can put the dots and join the numbers. And I think that's what dot-to-dot evangelism is, demonstrating the rationality of our faith and the coherence and the comprehensive nature of what we have to share. And that might take place over time, it might take place over many conversations, it might take place in one university lecture. But there are ways we can do this to demonstrate our truth. So all around us are intimations of transcendence. G.K. Chesterton put it this way. It's a platitude, and nonetheless true for that, that we need to have an ideal in our minds with which to test all realities. But it is equally true and less noted that we need a reality with which to test the ideals. One of the things I like being a Christian is because I am in the reality business. You know, people think that being a Christian makes you a make-believer, right? You escape reality. You need a God to assuage your Freudian angst over the universe, or it's a Schopenhauer projection of a God that's a need for fear of nature, or it's a system of control over reality, or you're imposing some kind of religious moralism because you have an authoritarian personality, a.k.a. Martin Luther or Calvin or something of this nature. There are all kinds of, or it's a gene or a meme. That's the latest thing, isn't it? My genes made me do it, my Levi's or my Wranglers. Whatever, you know, there's some other thing. What it can't be is something that is really there. The fact is, Christians are not afraid of reality. In fact, reality is our business. But we take all of reality, the seen and the unseen, the spiritual side as well, the longings of the heart, the deeper sense of life, and we can connect and we can make sense of the appearances because we understand how life works. And so we've got to therefore draw people towards that, expose illusions, use creativity, imagination, and song. Art is a powerful tool. That's why I think we need a lot more use of Christian arts in Europe, using the visual, using the musical, using the... And Europeans love this, don't they? You go down to Austria, you put up a little concert, you'll get people out the door. You'll get any same in Germany. You have a talk on something, art appreciation, or do something on wine, or whatever it is, anything to do with beauty and culture, you'll get people there. But can we connect the threads of that as a testament to the existence of our God and the created nature of reality and how the world works in all of its magnificence? I have a friend of mine, Ken Boa, in Atlanta. And Ken will do things. He takes him on a tour of the universe. He'll put together these visual presentations that absolutely are stunning. And what he does is he'll start from, if you like, goes out into the astrophysics, going to weigh up pictures of stars from the Hubble telescope and beautiful pictures of cosmology. And every now and again, there'll be some music in the background and a couple of references to the Psalms, just seated in here, and just keeping going out. And then all of a sudden, it zooms right down. You come right back to Earth, like in the BBC documentary. And you start getting moving, and then you get to the microscopic world. And you move smaller and smaller from animals to plants, and then you're into the world of biology and microbiology, and you see this finesse, and then at the end... Maybe Psalm 8, what is man that you're so wonderfully made? And then just opens up for questions. And you can be sure there are a lot of questions. Because chance and necessity, when it's confronted by this specific diversity, beauty, combination, magnificence, goes out the window in a real conversation. It doesn't mean you say they all walk out and say they're Christians, but it gets people thinking. And that's where we want to go. So let me do the coherence of faith, and then we'll have a last Q&A, and you can stone our host here. I love this. This is one of my favorite Lewis quotes, but I think it makes sense. And over the years, it's come to mean very much in my own soul. He said, I believe in Christianity as I believe the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it, I see everything else. Lewis wrote this a bit later on in his Christian faith. This is after, remember, he's been a professor, he's been a skeptic, really a rationalist in many respects, till he's about 36 years of age. And all of a sudden, you know, once he sees a Christian, he writes his first book, and his first book wasn't all that great necessarily, but you could see all the influences around his life. He had played with the occult, and he had played with pantheism, and he played with all kinds of different things. But now, Christianity, it was like the lights came on. And now it filled in all kinds of pieces of the universe that he couldn't understand fully beforehand. So he now saw the explanatory power that Christianity offered. And I think that's a marvelous tool. I was in New York City, not last week, but the week before. I don't know how many of you have been to New York, but it overpowers you. I mean, it is simply a city that the presence of its imminence, I mean, it's what John Lennox talked about. It crowds you, the noise, the streets, the smells, and it's a very invasive place. But to see New York, you need to really do two things. I mean, you can't, you know, you've got to do the part. You've got to walk Fifth Avenue, you know, walk up and down Manhattan, go into one of the clubs, have a falafel, you know, sit in an Italian restaurant or any restaurant, because every restaurant in the world is in New York, and they all speak the original languages. And it's fabulous. But then you go up the top of the Empire State Buildings and you look out and you see the Hudson River and, you know, wow, the East River. You get two perspectives. So we need both of these. We need to help people see the street and come up higher, look down below, feel and see. And with Christianity, we've got to do both. I think we have been good sometimes at showing the street level Christianity and not giving the big picture. And we need to have this combination. Or, on the other hand, we give such a big picture, it doesn't make sense to the reality of the person on the street. We need to be able to show and tell. And the first trigger in that, I think, is transcendence. That the pull that transcendence... Isn't it interesting how much of our world is... You know, here we're this highly secular age. Look at your television. The world's populated with zombies and aliens. They're popping up from everywhere. Literally. I mean, the walking dead, and they never seem to stay dead. You know, they just keep, you know, walking. And they're endlessly consuming, just dead entities who just eat and consume. That's a picture of our time, isn't it? Vampires. And, of course, vampires have evolved over the years. It used to be showed a cross through certain things, but not now. I mean, they can eat and destroy anything because they're eternal creatures. It's all about love anyway, you know, because it works with teenagers and the sexuality story and becoming and belonging. Well, do you want to be up when you grow up, Mommy? I want to be a vampire. So we've lost the plot in some sense, and yet we're looking all the time. Maybe E.T. is going to come and rescue us. Maybe Prometheus came and dropped off our DNA, and we found out they seeded it in a bad way, and actually they're evil aliens, and so we're off in the galaxy. We're still looking, so we can't get to the roots of the alien plot either. That's in the film trilogy. You might not get that illusion, but never mind. But the transcendence is never going away. What is the nature of reality? They're hungering for it. And naturalism doesn't answer this. Richard Dawkins, to the best extent, Sam Harris, and all the rest of the crew, the Horsemen of the Apocalypse and their cousins, they do not have the answers. It is a dead philosophy. You're either going to be an existentialist, a nihilist, or a Buddhist. And Europeans are trying all of those, aren't they? A New Age or some version of that. So the appeal to fit or the best sense. One of the things that makes Christianity so beautiful is its comprehensive nature. Think about it. You know, you have Christians in every conceivable discipline. You have people who are university professors. You've got people who are mechanics. You've got people who make things or build things or go out and fish or, you know, make wonderful cakes and do all kinds of things, design things. And Christians have been involved and are involved in every conceivable enterprise. They're often at the cutting edge of exploratory type things. So rather than playing the underdog, we should be thinking about what the power of our message is to unleash in our souls, this creativity that's given to us by our great creator God. And it is because we worship him. It is because he gives order. It's because he gives sequence. It's because he gives harmony that these things are all possible. And that explains reality. McGrath talks again about Lewis's vision. He said, for Lewis, the kind of sense-making offered by the Christian vision of reality is about discerning a resource between its theory and its way of the world, as the way the world seems to be. His theoretical spectacles seem to bring reality into sharp focus, just as a false theory presents us from seeing what is really there. One of the things, I don't think Christianity is easy. I find my Christian faith very difficult. Anybody else in the room apart from me? Am I the only one? I struggle to be a believer. I've struggled to stay a believer at times. I've been disappointed by the church. I've been disappointed by the pettiness of some of our thinking and the idiocy of things I've seen. But I've never been able to escape the reality of the gospel. That Christ actually does save. He does forgive. And he builds with broken people like you and I. And he makes a church. And he chooses the weak things of this world to confound the wise. It's a strange God. But then he died on a cross and it all looked like it was over when he went that route. And so the cross itself is the upside down kingdom, isn't it? It's a strange way of working, but it is the way of God. And it does make sense. It makes sense to me when I look at my humanity and my longings, both in my great desires, but also in my brokenness. That Christianity has a narrative structure that explains that and makes sense of that. Francis Schaeffer appealed to a generation lost in a sea of relativism. Tim Keller today in New York City and many other pastors like some of you in this room in Lyon and in France and many other places, you're doing the same. You stand up on a Sunday and you preach God's word. You minister to people. You offer the sacraments. You go out there. You show life and light. And it maybe trickles at the moment, but it brings hope in reality. And a little glimpse of Narnia comes through the clouds of darkness. And I think we need to pray that through things like the European Leadership Forum, there would be a mighty spiritual movement again in Europe. A renewal, a moral and spiritual awakening, where we see a greater boldness into the European Parliament, into Moscow, into Kiev, bringing the gospel into the public square. McGrath says this, the essential point to appreciate is that Lewis's approach to apologetics allows the integration of an appeal to human longing, for example, based on the beauty of the world or memories of one's childhood, within a thick, rational approach to the Christian faith. Lewis's argument is that the Christian map of reality adequately accommodates such longings, offering an explanation of their origins, accounting for their significance, and indicating how they may be fulfilled. So, I want to conclude with Colossians 4. We can then have a few minutes discussion or interaction, as you wish. In Colossians 4, 5, and 6 is Paul, and it's one of my favorite New Testament letters these days. I've gone back to it time and time again because of just the centrality of the Christology there. You know, Colossians 1, 15 through 20 is absolutely magnificent. You put it with John 1, 1 through 5 and Hebrews 1, 1 through 4. And this sense, and Paul hasn't even been to this church. And he knows the struggle going on. You see that in chapter 2, 4, and verse 8 as well. There's a sense of something, they're being unsettled in their faith. They've just begun. And yet this colossal picture of Christ that he portrays as the apologetic answer to the church in Colossae and to us in our time. But in chapter 4, towards the end, as he's talking to the church as a final conclusion, he says, conduct yourselves with wisdom towards outsiders, making the most of the opportunity. Let your speech always be with grace, as though seasoned with salt, so that you will know how you should respond to each person. I like that bit particularly, how you should respond. I think as evangelicals, we've often focused on the what and not enough on the how. And it's not to swing the other way. The what and the how can never be separate. If you don't have a good what, then you say the wrong thing. But those two things must be, and that goes back to the young lady's comment on the embodied expression. If there is a show, then there can be a tell. If there's no show, there is no tell. So I hope that makes sense to you. Thank you. What's your name? So I don't keep calling you. Sorry, Beth. That's right. Beth. Hi, Beth. Well, the question was, go back to the point on the use of philosophy, theology, and primacy. And then that particular illustration takes it into a slightly different area because I think Newbegin's point was speaking more broadly to the church in general, where the tendency was to do her theology based upon philosophical speculation and then sometimes come up with a reduced concept of God and categories that constrained the narrative and weakened some of its impact. So his appeal was trying to get back, let the scriptures set the theology of God, even if those are shatterer descriptors. And that those. So now when you go out to your second scenario, if you like, with a Muslim thing, where again, they are coming in and framing the debate, there I would tackle, rather than answering the spot, is go after the frame itself. So can I, before I answer the question, how would you as a Muslim, so you're saying, so we have to rationally defend our truth based on rational, they're actually establishing the very method. So challenge them, because how would that work with Islam?
Right. Well
it wouldn't, would it?
Yeah.
Because if the Quran is simply a dictation and does not need to be rationally defended, here they're claiming rationality to establish something that is not rationally defensible.
Yeah.
Now, is there a strong philosophical tradition? There is. And we know Avicenna and all the whole roots of... But this is a methodological category, which, and obviously the gay movement and many other things do the same type of thing. They establish the rules, and then by boldness and rhetorical insistence, force you to play by those rules. So I think the point there is to challenge the rules of the game and say, can we, you know, I will come back with an answer if first we can qualify why we would use these rules in the first place.
Sure.
And that's what I'd put, bring it to visibility. Yeah. How does the leading of the Spirit play out in, you know, you mean me individually or in RZIM as a whole? Well, I think personally, I think when you get an invitation or someone comes to us, I mean, the first thing we all do is, should we take this? We start praying about, is it something I can do, I should do, is a topic? And then when you're into, you try to get as much information as you can about the audience. So you're praying about them, Lord, what would I say and how would I say it? And what age are they? What are they interested in? Why this topic? So I think that's where the Spirit comes and hopefully giving you some kind of shape to the topic and the particular way you're going to put your argument together. I think then when you come to the time when you're actually doing your talk, you're praying again that you will be anointed and helped as you speak, and that when things come up, particularly in the floor, that you won't rush to answer. Because sometimes there's something going on behind the question, as you know, that someone's saying something that's really, and maybe it is aggressive, and they're coming out, but they're setting you up for a fall, and if you play the game, you're going to go into the minefield, or that there's something going on behind it, you know, and you just say, could I just ask you another question? And you, as you burrow down, you begin to see that there's some real hurt in the person's life. And so they're coming out of aggression or something like that. So I think those are the ways. And you know, all of us, as we grow in our faith, we struggle to learn to listen to God appropriately. And we're not always sure we got it right. Sometimes it's like, the heavens seem silent and I've still got to speak in 2 minutes, you know. So, ouch, I wish I had that sense that this was really God's word, you know. But, I mean, talk to some of these pastors. I mean, our dear brother, he's been preaching for 29 years. I mean, how many Sundays do you get up and feel, I wish this was the anointed word of the Lord, but, I mean, they've heard me for 29 years, you know. And you just, in faith, sometimes you do go right ahead. Does that make sense? Yes, sir.
Yes.
Well, there are, in the States, there are groups like Probe Ministries, the Christian Worldview Academy, are doing it for younger people. But often what I think, if you're wanting to do it in a local church, there's also a lot of online curriculums. We've got some stuff available as RZIM, Ask Curriculum for Young People. We've got the Online Academy that just got launched a couple of months ago. But you can also do books. I would think if you want to have more of a pastoral, people like Tim Keller's book, actually, Reason for God, is a very good, it's got a good study guide that comes along with it. I think there's video materials you can use alongside that. There's also Bryce, does anyone know Nashville? God is Not Dead. He's a pastor in Nashville, and he's started a massive movement basically all across the States, around the world actually. Very, very good apologetic both ministry through the local church, but also in campuses around the world. And it's very much in the context of church and church life. But it's still rich, it's still profound, but it doesn't necessarily have to go, you know, up to like a PhD level.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.